This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn. I'm Troy Antic. Shivaji Das is here. He is the author of Journeys with the Caterpillar, Traveling Through the Islands of Flores in Sumba, and Sacred Love, Erotic Art in the Temples of Nepal. His most recent is Angels by the Murky River. Shivaji, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you're a management consultant by day. Why do you write?
My job also takes me to a lot of places around the world, and I see and meet different kinds of people. And I had always been interested in writing. What I used to write earlier were more nationalistic essays and patriotic accounts, but that has changed over time. And what I find really interesting now is the stories of the people that I meet when I travel. And I believe that it not only keeps the experience of meeting them and the memories of them stronger in my mind, so writing is a way to sort of make these memories more permanent, but also my small attempt to make these stories, these wonderful stories of people that I met, known to the wider world.
Is there a relation between the frequency and the times that you've traveled, that you've moved away from those nationalistic themes?
it has been maybe an evolution of my personality as well. And the more experiences I've got, it has changed me in different ways. So when I grew up in a very conservative, traditional Bengali society where studying is the most important. You don't go out of your house. You don't talk to strangers. So that means that your experiences are much more limited. But once I ventured out on my own, I met different people. I had experience of sights of people living in horrible conditions or people who do not have some of the basic necessities that I was able to enjoy. So that changed my outlook, that changed my perspective. And over time, the kind of books I read also changed me in a way. And this is the person now I am today. Not the most nationalistic or patriotic. I believe in universal human values and everyone is the same.
Yeah, this emphasis on education, I think, is quite universal across developing economies, isn't it? Because we strive and we are aspirational. Is there a lot to unlearn in that, because so much of your upbringing is like studying, not talking to people, as you say. Now in this like books like this and your other books as well, you are constantly talking to strangers and you are asking them about intimate parts of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe what education, the formal education that we receive, sort of prepares some groundwork in terms of being able to analyze things or look at things from a logical perspective. But what the experiences, which later come into the life, sort of provides the fire to the pot in that sense. So all the theories that you have learned, all the morality lessons that you have learned, these real life experiences challenges them and also refines them in some way. That's what I believe.
Angels by the Murky River. Tell me about the title and how you came up with it.
Mm-hmm. So the original title that we were thinking for this book was Non-Required Travel, inspired by Wisława Szymborska, the great Polish poet, her writings on very simple topics called non-required readings. And my travels were sort of similar in that sense. They were not talking about the usual attractions, the architectural or the natural wonders, but lives of very simple people. Could be homeless people in Mumbai or Seoul, could be boxers, Filipino women boxers, could be diamond miners in Indonesia, security guards in Malaysia. So these are lives of these kind of people, and that's why it was non-required travel. But what we also thought when I was talking to my publisher, that one of the stories in this book is titled Angels by the Murky River, and this is what has given the title to the rest of the book. And this story is about a small town in Philippines, in the island of Bohol. And they have this Lobok River, which runs through it. And over the last 20, 30 years, there have been a series of natural disasters. There have been earthquakes, cyclones, landslides, and the town has been wrecked even before it could stand up time and again. But this town also happens to have this children's choir, which is financed by the villagers themselves, who come together to sponsor their children to learn music. And they have become internationally famous. So they have won competitions in China, in Europe, in the United States. And over the last 30 years, these children with their angelic voices have been the only good news in this otherwise heartbroken town. So that's what gave the name to the story and to the larger book, because in a way, the whole book is about finding these inspirational stories or wonderful lives of people among all the drudgery and all the turmoil that they have to go through.
How did you find this particular story?
So I was traveling in Cebu for a literary festival, and one of the organizers of the festival was just talking to me that, what are your plans for traveling? And he said that, okay, maybe you should visit, there was a library, a mobile library in the island of Bohol, which is nearby. And also maybe you should visit Miss Philippines, who happens to be in the same town. And maybe you should also visit this group of children who are singing over there. And by some coincidence, we managed to get one of the mothers of one of these children to take us into her house. So we stayed there with her family for a few days, and we could observe the practice rehearsal sessions. We could understand in detail the seniors who had passed through the school. They have come back, so their life stories and why they have come back. So it was a very enriching experience for me to be right in the center of the people and the families that were creating these angels.
Do you think about your reader when you're writing? Like, who do you write for?
That's an interesting question. I would say my primary reason to write for is actually myself. So it's the stories that, as I said, it keeps the experience of traveling deep in my memory. And many of my writings, they don't see the end of the day, but I do write just for the sake of remembering them over and over and go through them again and understanding the whole context better. I also do research on the sites to understand the historical, social context behind what I have encountered to support that. So I would say less than 30% of what I write actually sees the appears in a page. Nonetheless, I do have to think of the reader in terms of how do I structure the whole story, how do I bring in the perspectives in a sort of recognizable as well as attractive way format for the reader. So there the reader does come in, but I'll still say it's a very selfish endeavor that I indulge in when it comes to writing.
So these are the ones that you thought deserve more readership from your travels?
Yeah, I thought so. Partly because these were the ones which I found the strongest in terms of the appeal. Also, I had a reasonable amount of material which could present a relatively larger picture or a complete holistic picture to the reader. There have been isolated experiences in many places which I've cherished a lot, but they are too personal or too short for a reader to be excited about. Yeah, so those are not part of this collection. Of course, there are longer narratives that I've written based on my long trips in Indonesia and Nepal, and these are shorter ones among those.
Because this is 31 stories across 16 countries. Mm-hmm. How long did you have to take to travel across, and how long did you take to write the book?
Mm-hmm. So this book has been a work of which has been going on for over 6 years. My travels were not continuous. They had been often and now and then shorter trips to different parts of the world over the last 6 years. Some of these stories had already appeared in travel or nonfiction journals and magazines around the world, and some of them had not. So this is more of a collection. My other books, as I mentioned, they are more on a single destination.
I'm speaking today to Sivaji Das. He's the author of Angels by the Murky River, Travels off the Beaten Path. We'll talk more about the book after this short break. You're listening to BFM 89.9. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Troy Intik. My guest today is Sivaji Das, author of Angels by the Murky River. You were talking a little bit about how you like to write about your travels more to remember what happened. And this relationship between traveling and writing, is it not tiresome for you to have to remember everything all the time because you have to be constantly present and remembering the details? Do you take a lot of pictures? Like, do you find yourself having to find a quiet corner after an interesting encounter to just record that conversation that you had?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say the first and foremost, I consider myself as a traveler. Yeah, so the writing comes next. Whenever I travel, my first purpose and the most important purpose for me is to enjoy the whole experience, to enrich myself from the whole experience. And I would say that in many ways, whenever I have traveled, especially in the developing parts of the world, the small gestures of kindness from strangers, they have really left the deepest mark and have sort of softened my soul. So traveling in a way is also a way to rejuvenate myself and have a reaffirmation in the sense of humanity in the world. So the writing is way beyond in priority when it comes to my whole idea of traveling. What I usually do is every day, let's say I'm traveling to a certain place, every day at the end of the day, I would just take a few notes, just remembering some of the key dialogues or some of the key moments that I've had during that day. I have devised a very unique contraption, which is a small keyboard which can be rolled over. It's one of those plastic keyboards, and I usually fix that to my phone using a USB cable. So at the end of the day, I write it because it's easier that way. It's faster. I don't have to handwrite it and then convert it. And then it's also easy to carry in a backpack, which is the one I usually always take for my long trips.
You don't buy into that the idea that some writers have that you have to make that your writing makes you more connected with your thought because you have to write it out. It's not so easy to erase it. You have to form a thought in your mind before mm-hmm. you can mm-hmm. express it on the page.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I think there are different objectives or schools of travel writing in that sense. Some of the travel writers, such as I would say Colin Thubron, they are very internal focused. Yeah, their writing is whenever they are traveling, their writing is a lot more about themselves and how they feel, less about the people. I belong to another school, I would like to say, which is a bit more objective, where I believe that as a writer, I should be as far behind the picture as much as possible. So it is less of my thoughts, but it's more of what I'm experiencing and the words of the people that I'm meeting and what they are saying and finding a way. As a writer, my responsibility or my job is to find a way to channel these experiences and these dialogues as objectively as I can, forming an overall structure in the background so that the people get a sense of these people and these experiences that I've encountered rather than my feelings and my voices. So it's less, I believe that that's the reason why I do not need to form those concrete ideas while I'm traveling and noting it down at the same point. It would also be very troublesome for my fellow travelers as well as for the people I'm interacting with, I believe.
But don't you think people want to know your take on what you got from that encounter? Because mm-hmm. I think the best travel books, it's very subjective, isn't it? It's mm-hmm. a very strong point of view on mm-hmm. what they see in their encounters. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are. I would say some of the writers such as Richard Kapuscinski or even some of V.S. Naipaul's earlier works, they are less subjective in that sense. They let the voices that they meet speak for themselves and let the reader sort of form an opinion about that place more. One of the challenges with travel writing is that you meet only so many people and you meet only certain sections of the people that are there in a particular place. And to take that and to form very strong opinions, and even in the broader context of the research that is available, could be dangerous, I believe, in my opinion. So if I were to say, recently I went to Abkhazia and Georgia, and these two territories have disputes between themselves. So a few Abkhazians were saying quite bad things about Georgia, but it's a much more complex issue. And if I were to form an opinion just based on that, which is likely to be also influenced my biases, my own biases over time, this could be dangerous and could be also doing harm to the whole society that I have visited. So I, as a rule, sort of, I try to stay away from that as much as possible. Of course, my biases and my viewpoints will somehow creep into the stories I select as well as the viewpoints I try to position. For example, I did a story on the salt miners of Indonesia, And they were definitely complaining a lot about the middlemen who they have to interact with. But maybe because of my biases or maybe for other reasons, I took only their viewpoints. I didn't take the viewpoint of, let's say, this middleman himself. Yeah. So, and that is what is often there in any travel writing, that you can never have a universal sample of human beings to present the completely objective picture in that sense.
I would like to know what are your biases and viewpoints on the story you wrote about the Bolitas, am I saying it right, in the Philippines? So tell me about that and how you found out about that story.
Yeah, so I was traveling in a container ship together with my wife. So we are going from Singapore to Hong Kong. And
why a container ship? You kind of let that slip.
Yeah, it was an interesting way of traveling because unlike taking a cruise ship, here you are pretty much with the crew. Yeah? The only source of entertainment here is a small gym where you have a makeshift bicycle, and everything else is about watching the seas and talking to these crew who are running the ship. And all of them have very interesting lives. You know, you have people from India, from Romania, from Philippines, from France, each of them doing different jobs. Each of them have different viewpoints. So to understand their lives and their perspective of living in the sea for 6 to 8 months in a row and what that brings about to themselves. For example, the captain was saying that when he sees a port like Hong Kong, it's such a wonderful experience because after 6 months, his eyes are craving for some green, yeah? Or when they heard a female voice, my wife's announced good evening on the radio, the emergency radio, which has to be kept on. Everyone was shocked and there was a stark silence in the emergency radio, which is usually very noisy because people say all kinds of things there, nothing useful. Like even porn audio is telecast, Chinese sailors, they sing during that. So one of the henchmen whose name is Ishmael, not the Moby Dick Ishmael, but another Ishmael, he announced that, oh, that's a mermaid. Yeah. So there were these very interesting experiences. They were also sharing about their superstitions that they have on the ship. And sailors are some of the most superstitious people in the world. The Romanians, they don't turn their back against the bridge. The French will never say the word rabbit. So all these experiences were very delightful. And it was such an interesting way to travel. And I would do that anytime whenever I have some flexibility. And
how did you get on? And what is the art? Like take off you and your wife.
So many of these container ships or oil ships, they do have one or two vacant rooms most of the time, which are usually meant for either engineers or inspectors. So you need to write to these ships and hopefully they will have a vacancy at some point of time. And because they charge you a nominal amount, they would take you in. Some shipping lines, they are a bit more restrictive about it, but some of them do take you in. And then at the immigration, you need to say you are one of their staff and you are doing some consulting work. So that's how you get on board. The crew was actually very friendly because about 30 people manage a ship which can carry about 1 million kilograms. So they are very lonely. It's 30 people in a 300-meter long ship. Mm-hmm. And they're always willing to talk and explain and share, put out their whole lives in front of you. So they are delighted to have us around. And we felt very much like babies with all these parents taking care of us all along. And coming back to the Bolitas, yeah. I think when it came to superstitions, they also have these peculiar habits of sailors. And over history, most of the brothels and centers of prostitutions have been around the ports. Yeah, even today, if you go to Makassar, the red light area is right across the port that they have. Singapore is also famous for some of its towers of heaven or hell in Orchard, which are mostly frequented by sailors. And Filipino sailors are particularly well known for their bolitas, which are small steel balls which they put around their male organs because the Brazilian prostitutes are known to prefer such organ shapes and sizes when the sailors visit them. So that's the story of Boletas.
Yeah, it's not just they put it on, right? They sew it on?
They sew it inside, yeah. Because if they put it on, it will be too obvious. So they sew it inside. And this is usually done by sailors themselves. They do it to each other because it's not a service that you can get in a hospital.
You know, earlier you said you're always very grateful and maybe even surprised by the hospitality that you receive in places of extreme poverty. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, do you feel conflicted when you write about them? Like, are you wary of it turning into poverty porn, for example?
Yeah, that's a very good point and something that I'm conscious of as well. For example, I wrote one of the stories in this book is about the homeless people in Mumbai. And again, growing up in India, coming from that sort of traditional mindset, we have certain idea of the homeless, the street people whom we think as opportunists who are actually part of a cartel, who are trying to beg and get money from you despite being very able-bodied to do a normal work. But when I met and interacted with these homeless, I found out that they're actually very hardworking and they have been homeless over generations, living under the flyover without any roof over their head. And it's just the nature of their informal work which gives them so less bargaining power that they are stuck into that position for more than 40, 50 years over generations. They live there, they married there, they die there, and they're buried there. Yeah, and even there, people were so kind to me. They offered me tea with whatever resources they had. They offered me some food. And I was shocked by that, that kind of hospitality. So when I wrote this story about them, I was thinking that, okay, in these book talks and these book launches, people clap and people admire these stories, but the homeless are still living there, probably not even aware that I'm talking about them and getting these adulations. So that is definitely in my mind. And in my small way of contributing to their welfare, what I do is, for example, in my first book, The Journeys with the Caterpillar, all the amounts that I received from royalties were donated to the charities that worked with these communities. For this book as well, I try to be in touch with many of these people that I've written about as much as possible. So, for example, the homeless story in Mumbai as well. I'm in touch with Alternative Realities, which is the organization that works for them, and I have tried to promote their work and help them get donations by writing in different magazines about these stories.
So, because your work deals a lot with, I guess, governments and private sector, mm-hmm. what are your thoughts about developments?
Mm-hmm. So development is a very complicated topic. You know, it's something which can never create a full glass for anyone. That's the way to it. And often we have taken to confused development with shiny buildings and smooth highways and metros connections and high-speed trains. But oftentimes we misunderstand or fail to judge the full impact of this, and issues such as equity of access, equity of possibilities for moving up the social ladder, these are taken less into consideration when it happens. And increasingly what I also found is that and the environment is also another big aspect which needs to be considered when we think about development. I mean, I as a younger person, I didn't think that environment was that important as long as people were moving up, their incomes were moving up. But when you see pictures of orangutan mothers hugging their children and they are chased out of the burning forest, and you realize that these animals are utterly homeless in front of our idea of development. So these are some of the factors that we need to take into consideration and need to think through in detail when we think about development equity for not just us as human beings, but also for these voiceless creatures which are sharing this earth with us. Because being human is not just thinking about yourself and your family and even the wider humanity, but also for future generations of not just yourselves, but also all other species that exist in this earth. That's what I believe.
But in the near term, a lot of people migrate with great odds to work in a foreign country. Mm-hmm. And you speak to them, the migrant labor, to engage them to write about their experiences. Mm-hmm. Well, at least in Singapore, where you're based, and in mm-hmm. Malaysia. And I was wondering if you can tell me more about how you come to care about this community and what has been the reception to what they have to say.
Mm-hmm. So, also coming from my background, my parents were migrants. They were migrants from East Pakistan, then East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, to India. And I have always been a migrant myself. So my parents also moved to a part where they don't speak. The majority don't speak Bengali, which is my mother tongue. And that's where I grew up. And then I migrated to Mumbai, Delhi, a few other places, then Singapore. So I've been a migrant always in my life. But what I've seen is that there are these two clear distinctions among migrants. They're the better skilled one, the ones who can negotiate and can bargain, not just with their employers, but with the government as well. And then there are these lower skilled migrants, you know, who come from the poorest countries. And they are the ones who have often the least access to voice their opinions. They are often exploited by employers. The government has laws because they are not voters. The government doesn't care as much as they would for their citizens. So oftentimes it is very easy for politicians around the world to excite opinions against these migrants. And they are often taken as criminals. They are taken as husband snatchers. They are taken as thieves. And we've often tend to disregard themselves as human beings. Even people we have seen in the trains, they get up when a migrant comes and sits next to them in the train. So these are small gestures as well that humiliate these migrants, and they have taken this for granted. And many of my stories, even in this book, though they don't deal directly with the communities I work with in Singapore and Malaysia, because I don't usually write about communities I directly work with. But what I've found is that being outsiders in the society, they have a certain view of the country or the place that they are living in that is quite unique often and sort of challenges the idea that the compatriots or the citizens of the country have. So I have stories about the Korean migrants in Korea, how they are treated, and also stories about domestic migrants in China. And in Singapore and Malaysia specifically, what I've been doing together with a few other volunteers is to have organized poetry competitions, photography events, and other sort of literary and artistic events, which give these migrant workers, the lower skilled migrant workers, a forum or a voice to showcase their concerns, their ideas of the country that they are living in. And the idea is that with these competitions, one, the locals would have a different idea of migrants and understand their situation, their lives behind, also the sophistication of their thought, which will help to elevate their understanding of migrant workers. And at the same time, give a platform to these migrant workers to showcase their opinions. So far, in all the countries that we have organized these competitions, Singapore, Malaysia, our friends are doing this in UAE as well as in Hong Kong and China as well for domestic migrants. It has received, it has been received by great enthusiasm by the locals, yeah, especially the artistic segments or artistic people related to arts in these countries. They have been very supportive and collaborative. And now we are seeing that these migrants, workers, they are taking these activities, they are doing them on their own rather than looking at myself or others as channels or conduits or agents to let their talent flourish. And that's really encouraging for me, that we are reaching a state of greater assimilation and greater understanding, not just for the high-skilled migrant workers, but for these much less privileged migrant workers.
Would there be a book you recommend where we can have a glimpse of this experience?
Okay. I would strongly recommend the book The Beast by Oscar Gutierrez, if I'm not wrong, his name. It's a book on, not on this region, but in Latin America. So it's, it covers the train, which is called The Beast, which runs all across from, I believe, from Honduras all the way to the U.S. border. And it's about the lives of migrants who are moving from the South American countries. And this train is called The Beast because so many unfortunate things happen along these trains. Sometimes people get thrown over, they lose their hands, sometimes the way they are exploited by people in each of the towns that they across along their journey. So it's a very, very emotional account and a very direct account of the actual journeys undertaken by these very normal people with very normal lives and responsibilities just for the sake of creating that extra dollar for their family members.
You are a consultant, you write as well, and you do advocacy work too. How do you manage your time? Each and any one of those could be a full-time vocation.
Yeah. So, of course, my primary responsibility is still to my colleagues and people who report to me and make sure that the work gets done. When it comes to writing, what I try to do is to be a bit disciplined about it. And I try to write every day for half an hour. And over time, that sort of adds up. I'm not such a prolific writer. This is only my third book in the last 6 years.
That's three more than most everyone.
So what I've noticed is that over time, you know, this the whole thing about drops of water making up an ocean sort of comes into place. Regarding my advocacy work, we have reached a stage where I have got enough friends and platform to make this a system which can run by itself. And I just bring in the connections. I just bring together the migrants and the refugees with the writers, with the sponsors, with the venues and all that, because I have those networks. So the time required from my end for this work is fortunately, because of the initiatives taken by volunteers and the migrant workers and the refugees themselves, has become less and less over time. Yeah, so that's what's keeping it sustainable.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me here. Pleasure.
Angels by the Milky River is now available in bookstores. You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.